Hey, everybody. What up? What up? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is such always a pleasure to have you in the house to have a conversation with my guest. This conversation today is sort of, it's actually kind of very appropriate and timely because of a lot of the conversations have been going on around the country on social issues, the Supreme Court decisions coming out this as recently as today, the last day of the court. And so Dr. Honorable Jason Johnson is the man to have for that conversation to help break down the insanity of it all. He is a professor, political analyst, and public speaker. He is the author of the book, Political Consultants and Campaigns, One Day to Sell. He is a tenured professor in the School of Global Journalism and Communication at the Morgan State University in the great city of Baltimore, Maryland, and a contributor and colleague and definitely a friend of mine at MSNBC, The Griot, and a host of the Slate podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. I appreciate that long introduction. You know, half those things I try and hide from the IRS, but you know, we're doing
well. So that's all good. Well, I just you know, read it like you wrote it. So that's how it goes. Well, man, look, let's just jump into some pretty tight stuff right now, because today, as we're sitting down to have this conversation, the Supreme Court has come out with its last two rulings for this session. They're both important, certainly will have political impact and ramifications, and certainly will also change the way states behave. So let's deal with the easier one, which is the California case, where California had passed a law that required its charitable organizations that solicit donations from, you know, individuals to disclose their list of their contributors to the state's attorney general. The idea being that they wanted to check that list to make sure that there was no fraud. You know, people weren't using these charities and those donations to hide money or, you know, somehow engage in illegal activity. The court, in a 6-3 opinion, with the majority conservative members in the majority, basically said that California overreached. It cannot require that list, and in fact, as evidence presented to the court, and so stupid, California really hadn't taken any steps once they passed the law to actually do what they say they were going to do. So the court took all of that and said, sorry, no, that doesn't work. What's your thoughts on the decision there?
You know, I actually understand it from a free speech perspective.
Important. I think I'm glad you said it, because I meant to mention that's important, because while this was a 6-3 conservative majority, the petitioners in this case were a cross partisan group. So it wasn't just, the Board of Trade or other economic interests and conservative organs, but it was also, you know, liberal groups as well that did not like this action by the state.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that I should be able to give money to wherever I want, no one else should know. Like, at its core, I'm kind of in agreement with that. I'm kind of in agreement. The issue that I have is that, and this is, as you pointed out, this is the failure of California. You have to be able to demonstrate as a state entity examples of why having access to that information is ultimately a public good.
Right.
You can't just say, I want access to this because I want access to this, because some crappy may happen down the road. So, you know, it's same thing with like campaigns. Like, you got to disclose this ad was paid for by, this ad was paid for by, you know, I would like to know before I give to a certain organization what other people have given to it. That would be nice to know, but do I have to know that information? As a private citizen, I don't. And if the state knows it, eventually the private citizen could find out about it. I could do a Freedom of Information Act. So I do understand this. Now, that's all in well-placed, high-minded, best-case circumstances theories. I don't trust the six justices who are the conservative justices on this court anyway. So I know their reasons for doing it is that they can cover over neo-Nazis and all sorts of other crazy people. I know their motivation is not pure. So and look,
well, how do you know their motivation is not pure?
Because two of the people on the court are ridiculous scam artists who shouldn't be there anyway. Amy Comey Barrett shouldn't be there, and Brett Kavanaugh shouldn't be there, and actually Gorsuch shouldn't be there. None of those people should. So as far as I'm concerned, almost anything that they do, and again, I'm not a lawyer. I mean, I don't play one on TV.
Yeah, but you open up a can of worms there, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, Amy Comey Barrett has a body of jurisprudence as a judge. You may disagree with her opinions and her rationale, but you know, how is she different from Breyer? How is she different from Sotomayor? I mean, there are a lot of people look at Sotomayor and what the hell is she doing on the court? Oh, well, because she's Hispanic.
Well, she got slipped into office like 8 days before an election under completely hypocritical circumstances by Mitch McConnell. And I do think process matters.
That still doesn't mean that she's not qualified to be there just because she got slipped in 8 days before.
I think the circumstances under which you get the job are almost as important as the skills you have when you have it. Look, I mean, you can be the most qualified person in the world, but if you got the job dirty, then everything you do under those circumstances is suspect. Plus, anybody who got pushed in by that previous administration,
right,
I suspect was placed there in part because of their anti-democratic tendencies, because of the fear and concern on the part of Trump.
Yeah, but that's not been borne out with the number of rulings this year.
I get your
progressive bias. But this is something I know I say that as a tweak to my friend because we were just exchanging a couple of text messages a few days ago on this relative point and how progressive my friend is. I think it's too early to judge how the three justices you just named are going to rule. I remember conversations back in the day about the Chief Justice and how he was going to be this demagogic political actor as a Supreme Court, not just justice, but Chief Justice. And that has not necessarily borne itself out. Yeah, we can have debates over the issue over the rulings. I mean, they're, you know, I have an issue with the other case we're going to talk about, for example. But it is interesting to me how they, how this court, under this Chief Justice, at least, seems to have bifurcated some of the, healthcare decisions versus a decision like this, and the one we're about to talk about on voting rights, where you get to see a little bit more of that conservative kind of, ethos and politics emerge in the latter cases versus something like healthcare, where, the court seemingly stays pretty much center left.
Well, I also think that there's, so you've got two main theories of how the Supreme Court operates. You've got the legalism model and sort of the attitudinal model. The legalism model has said that, people interpret the law, they're driven by the law, whether you're strict constructionist, whatever, legalism, like you're trying to make this work with the law. I don't believe that. I've always thought that attitudinal is what drives, which is everybody's individual ideologies is driving it, and they just warp the law to whatever it is they think. We're not robots. If justices were robots, and if the law was completely determined by, just what's strictly in the law, then you could plug every question into a computer and get a darn answer. So because I don't trust the motivations of the men and women and how they were selected and what they were likely selected for, I can look at something like this first ruling and say, in theory, I get it because I believe in free speech. And part of free speech is I should be able to associate, i.e. give my money to anything and anybody.
So how would you assess the court if they ruled for California?
If they ruled,
would that change your prediction model on how they're going to rule on these cases?
No, it wouldn't change my prediction model. What I would say is, if they had ruled in favor of California, my expectation would have been they rule in a sort of very narrow way that has a timeline. Like, for now, we will rule that the collection of this information, Supreme Court's done this before. The collection of this information isn't inherently a violation. Down the road, if right. you are not able to demonstrate that this has been in favor of the public good, we would be open to somebody coming back. Like, that's what I would have think would have been an even fairer ruling, to say that I'll let you collect it, but like, at some point, you got to show me that this means.
Yeah, but that goes against free speech principles and freedom of association principles. Well, so you've got a violation of 1 and 8.
I don't think it inherently goes against free speech principles. If
well, it does if you see money as property, which most conservatives do.
Well, but see, I don't see money.
I'm just saying, most conservatives like myself view money right. as property, which is why I don't get upset at Supreme Court rulings when it comes to, campaign funds, for example. Right. I want to give Jason Johnson $1 million to run for office. I can give Jason Johnson $1 million. Now, where I draw a line and where I'm surprised the court came down the way it did, because a lot of us do believe that you are free to give that money, but good social public policy. And of course, here's my mistake. The court is not there to make public policy, but
so they say.
And in good measure, they don't, unless the Congress fails to act, which mm-hmm. is in these days, most days. Yeah. But the social policy should be that I can give you $1 million as long as you disclose that I gave you $1 million.
Right.
So that it's not a question of, we want to make sure that Michael Steele isn't hiding cash or cheating the system. It's more broadly that other donors should know who's backing and supporting you.
Right.
So that if I see that, Michael is a member of Proud Boys. Oh, okay. Guess what? I'm not. You take Michael's money. You go on about your business.
Well, yeah. One, as I mentioned before, I like to know so that I know who I'm mixing my money with. Right. Like, if I give to an organization and I find out that 5 other people giving to it, I have huge ideological problems with. I think it's a public good that I should know that, but also it's beneficial in order to prevent or anticipate potential corruption. Like I said, the best kind of ruling for me, I understand why the Supreme Court did what they did. I don't trust their motivations. The best kind of ruling for me would be like a stipulation saying, again, you can collect this information, but you have to be able to demonstrate at some point in the future that it is necessary for public good and public security. And again, I think campaigns versus quote unquote charitable organizations is also slightly different. Like, I gotta know who's putting money behind somebody who I'm voting for. That is an inherent, like, we have to know that kind of information. That's one of the, I think, did California pass this? I know a couple of places are trying. That's why these places that are pushing now after the 2020 election to say that if you're a party nominee, you gotta give up your tax return. I think that's a public good. If you're going to be president of the United States, I think I should be able to.
Would you apply that standard to any office?
No, I don't think.
Running for city council, running for mayor of Los Angeles, should I be required to give up my tax return?
No, I don't think.
How do you draw the distinction between the two?
For me,
president and mayor of Los Angeles.
Right. I think the distinction is, number one, because we do have some campaign finance disclosure laws, right?
Right.
It's a lot easier to find out who gave money to my mayoral candidates than my presidential candidates. I mean, remember we had the Clintons taking money from China, wink, wink, 30 years ago. Like, at that level, there's so many.
Well, the Clinton organization.
The Clinton organization.
Right.
So there's so many different Byzantine ways that someone at the presidential level can hide and sneak money in that I do think looking at their tax returns is more important for the public good, because I don't think the mayoral candidate, I don't think he or she can hide it as well. I would not have a problem with putting that requirement down to almost any federal office. Yeah. I wouldn't have a problem with that. The Senate and House, why not? We're trying to see that you're representing the people and that you're not completely in the tank for, you know, and again, there's opensecrets.org. Like, there's plenty of ways to find out, who gives to your campaign. But if you're serving in public office, I don't have a problem with the public having access to the last 10 years of your tax return. Now, not your husband, not your wife, not your kids, you know, not even necessarily your business, because hell, business competitors could try and use that to screw you over.
Right.
But I think your personal income taxes, if you are representing federal office, if you're in a position to make policy that could enhance your personal finances.
Right.
You know, i.e. Kelly Loeffler and things like that. I think that's reasonable. Okay. I wish we had a public that cared more about it, but
that's a whole nother conversation. So folks, if you thought we just warming up. You thought that was a hot topic.
All right, we're going to take a break. I told you, we just warming up, baby. We just warming up. We're going to take a quick break and we'll have more conversation with the good Dr. Jason Johnson right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. We're having our conversation with Jason Johnson. So the court's other decision, which came down, which really has folks back on their heels a bit, involves the Arizona case, a pair of voting restrictions from Arizona, disallowing provisional ballots cast outside the correct precinct and limiting those who can help return a completed ballot, which the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit struck down for violating Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So Arizona imposed these restrictions, and the Court of Appeals, Ninth Circuit said, I'm sorry, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act says, no can do. Voting right groups and others largely agreed that the Ninth Circuit misapplied existing law, and that these two particular voting restrictions do not violate Section 2. Now, so the fear coming into this decision, which was realized today, is the Supreme Court would issue a sweeping opinion, not only overturning the Ninth Circuit, but drastically curtailing the circumstances under which Section 2 could be used. So the long and short of it, America, is the Supreme Court did basically that.
Yeah.
The Voting Rights Act that was passed 1965, basically are just what's left are just words on paper.
Yep.
In the court in 2013, I believe, you know better than I do, I think, gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which dealt with preclearance, which states had to, if they were to make changes to voting provisions, voting laws in their states, certain states had to get preclearance. In other words, the Justice Department had to sign off and said, this change to the voting laws will not hamper or harm.
Disproportionately impact
voters, particularly minority voters in your state. So now they've gone about with this ruling today, Jason, to dilute Section 2. The dissenting opinion, the three judges there, they noted that if a law has a discriminatory impact on voters of color, then the law violates the statute, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, the majority's view was, well, how do you know that?
Right.
And so my response and summary of basically what the minority said was, well, if your grandma has to catch a bus
catch three buses to go vote when she used to be able to walk down to the end of the block. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's having a good discriminatory impact on her. But the majority says there now is a higher standard, Jason. That standard favors the state. And what we've seen in these rulings, both of these rulings by this court, by the Roberts Court, is that the burden now is on the citizens, not the state, to prove discrimination.
Yeah.
How effed up is that?
I'm not the least bit surprised. Honestly, Michael, every single voting rights activist, every voting organizer person who I've spoken to over the last, you know, certainly this year in 2021, they all expected this to happen.
Right.
Roberts has always hated the Voting Rights Act. This has been his ultimate goal. Like you said, okay, maybe he's okay with nominal versions of healthcare and other kinds of issues.
Right.
But he's never been in favor of the Voting Rights Act. And what they, you know, what you stated so eloquently, I'll say much more simply, the court basically ruled that unless Arizona passes a law called We Hate Negroes Act, basically.
Yeah, there's no standard.
They can do whatever they want
to me.
And they've been playing this game for years leading up to this point by arguing, well, we don't have a problem with states passing laws that screw over one party because that's just party competition. You know, that's not necessarily the same thing as a particular group or race of people. We know that's not true. So, I mean, this does not surprise me. We know what the motivation is behind it. The issue is simply going to be, can the Democratic Party put together some semblance of legislation, by the end of this year so that next year's elections are simply unfair as opposed to absolutely rigged? That's the only option at this point. You can't trust the Supreme Court. They're going to be, Trump and Mitch McConnell basically picked second year law students. Like, these people ain't dying anytime soon. And Justice Breyer is too arrogant and naive about his own influence in the world to get the hell out of office.
Yeah, I appreciate that point. I do appreciate the broader point. But with respect to Justice Breyer, what the hell do you think is going to happen if he announces his resignation tomorrow? What do you think is going to happen?
Then you would simply have the Democrats try to pick a new nominee, and it would be a tough fight, and then it would get the guy elected through the Senate.
How?
Because you'd have a 50-50 vote, and Dan Harris would, basically Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema would pick the person, but you'd have a 50-50 vote, and then Harris would be the deciding vote.
And you think Mitch McConnell's going to let that happen?
I mean, Mitch McConnell will try to stop it.
Oh,
but I don't.
Oh, given who he's up against in the Senate,
yeah.
Oh, he was that won't be a try for him.
I mean,
it won't be a try for him.
Chuck Schumer is not. It's not the.
It will not be a try for him. He always has a plan Z.
This is true, but either way,
and that's because they've already abolished the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. That's your point.
Right. Yeah. So it can still get done. But again, the larger scheme of things is this ruling is not a surprise to anybody. I mean, it just isn't. Like I said, well, honestly, when I tell you the New Georgia Project, people I know in Pennsylvania, people I know in Ohio, they have been anticipating this. Like this is not catching anybody by surprise.
So what's their response to it? You anticipate that I'm going to break into your home. What defense have you been able to put together to deal with it?
Literally all people can hope to do is you have a two-pronged effort. One, you have to keep pressuring Congress to hopefully pass some semblance of some bill somewhere. And then two, you have to basically, and it's a waste of time, it's a waste of energy, it's a waste of effort, it's racist and it's voter suppression, but you have to go about the process of not just registering people, but re-registering them and protecting them and engaging in a level of voter education that quite frankly shouldn't be necessary, but that you have to do in order to remotely have people have a chance to get elected, to actually vote next year. So what you have to do in Arizona is you got to say to people, okay, look, I know this seems crazy. I know this is annoying. I know this voting place has changed, but you can't accidentally send your vote somewhere. Like I don't care if we got to come by your house and tattoo it on your head, right? Essentially what these laws
do. There'll be a law against that after you do
it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't freaking hand out water when people are in you know, in Georgia. I mean, it's absolutely insane. Look, I will say this also, Michael, and I've argued this on the air and radio and podcast and everything else like that. Like, if I were Joe Biden, not Harris, and we should talk a little bit about Harris.
Yeah,
if I were Biden, you know, one of the things I would be doing in this voting rights push is, like, I would find a local election. I'd be like, look, let's call Democratic Party everywhere. If I were Joe Biden, I would stand in line with people. Like, I would make it a big, like, I'm going to invite every media, like, I'm going to stand in line with people in one of these ridiculously long lines for some municipal election in Texas or Ohio or something else like that. And then you scream from the top of the rafters to every single, all the suburbanites that he won over, all the married men that he won over. That was his big, you know, the Pew just dropped their new chunk of data. And the Pew said, look, you know, Biden really won this because he just overperformed with married men of all colors. Like,
yes. You're ahead of me. Yeah. That new data. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We'll talk about that, but go ahead.
So if I'm Joe Biden, I'm standing in line this August or something else like that in Ohio, one of these places, like, you know what? Look at this. Look at this. Hey, ma'am, how long have you been here? 2 hours. 2 hours. Your son Hunter and Christy, like, you're trying to take them to soccer, aren't you? Hey, sir, what about you? Yeah, like, you're an hourly wage. Doesn't this suck? You're an hourly wage employee. You're trying to fit, like, I would be standing. It's like Obama trying to stand by the 75 bridge that went through Boehner's district in Ohio. Right. And tried to make this big point about how we need to do infrastructure, which they wouldn't do because he was black and everybody hated him. But if I were Joe Biden, I would be doing that about voting rights. I really think part of the pressure that, and it's work, right? That's the only reason we're talking about voting rights now. I think part of the pressure that Biden and the administration have to talk about at all times is the burden and inconvenience. And when people find out something is inconvenient, that's when they'll scream and that's when they'll complain. You're not going to convince somebody, you know, in suburban Philly, they're not going to care about the philosophy of voting rights because most people don't. Right. But what you can do, I mean, there are Republicans in Harris County, Texas. There are actual Republicans there.
Yeah,
and some of those people had to wait in line and they're not happy about it. I mean, we all know Texas would be purple and or blue if it weren't for ridiculous gerrymandering and these kinds of laws. And that's what I would be doing if I were the Democratic Party. This is ridiculous. You should not have to wait 6, 7, 8, 9 hours just to freaking vote. It is ridiculous. You know what? I don't care that you can't give people water anymore. You shouldn't have to wait in line so damn long that you need water anyway. You shouldn't have to have a mariachi band performing.
Yeah, we got past that point.
Right.
Hello, wait a minute. Why are you in line this long that you actually need water?
Right. Like why have I waited in line longer to vote than it takes to get on Space Mountain? That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
and that's the kind of argument that I would be making.
What do we do about it, Jason? What do we do about it? What I work with a number of voting organizations and groups. I chair the U.S. Vote Foundation and Overseas Vote Foundation. We're much more working with boards of elections and election officials to get the right information in the hands of voters. For example, to your point about education, informing them when to vote, where to vote, et cetera. But a lot of these groups, and I gave a talk on Zoom earlier this week where I raised the point, asked the question, how many of you are actually dialed into all these other groups out here? Because mm-hmm. the strength of your opponents is that you're so fractured.
Right.
You're not presenting a united front. You are absolutely right. If Joe Biden got on a plane, got in a line this summer or fall in a primary for a primary election and stood in a line with voters
mm-hmm.
waiting to vote in one of those wonderfully red states that just changed all the laws.
Yeah.
It all of a sudden changes the conversation.
Completely changes.
So for me, why the hell don't Democrats think like that? Because that would have been I ask Democrats all the time. I look at them and say, do you have any idea how I beat you in 2010? Do you have any idea? Just like, put your hand up if you got a clue.
I mean, there was a They can run against the black guy. They can run against the black guy. I mean, like, but here's the thing. This is a mistake, and this again goes to some of the data that came out. The concern that I have, that I've always had, which is why I'm not a Democrat, right? Like, people can get mad at me and scream, I'm not a Democrat. I care about the health and benefit of this country because this is where all my stuff is, right? But I'm not a Democrat.
I'm just, when I put all my stuff someplace else, guess what?
Right. It's like, don't blow up the earth. That's where my stuff is, right?
But
what I say, because I think the Republican Party has basically become a fascist front at this particular, I mean, not basically, it is. In treasonous insurrectionists, what I say all the time is that Democrats are often pursuing the wrong kinds of voters, and they do not understand what the core motivations of people are. So again, people are driven by notions of convenience. People are driven by notions of fairness if the fairness affects them, right? Abstractly, they don't give a crap, but they can certainly care about fairness if it has a direct impact on them. I don't think Democrats always get that. And Democrats have always spent way too much time chasing after a working class, whatever, white demographic that collectively hasn't voted for them in the majority since the early 1980s. And whether that's Joe Biden doing it from a centrist perspective or Bernie Sanders doing it from a progressive perspective, it doesn't work. Now, the solution is not simply get more minorities to vote, right? Because you're facing voter suppression. And because, as we saw with Trump, Trump's sort of hyper-masculine racism and sexism can be very appealing to certain groups of minorities in this country, at least enough for him to remain competitive. And we also, in the grander scheme of things, and you know, this is a bit abstract, but I think it's important to understand, everybody who lazily sat on their rumps 15, 20 years ago was like, yeah, we're going to have this big demographic boom and Latinos are going to vote for Democrats and then it's all over. No, it doesn't work that way. Obviously, you don't know anything about Latino politics or culture or anything else like that. Not to mention the fact that, look, what we could be seeing right now in this country is essentially what happened in the 40s and 50s, which is when, for convenience sake and for a lot of other political reasons, you know, the Irish and the Italians and the Scottish suddenly became white. And that allows you to get in power.
That's true.
That's true. They were all sorts of other little things.
They were no longer ethnic.
Yeah. they weren't ethnic no more after World War II. Yeah. Right. They all became white. And we could see that with Latinos. We could see Latinos being sort of enveloped into whiteness, philosophical, ideological whiteness in America, at least from the standpoint of negative partisanship. Okay. I mean, like, anybody who spends any time in Texas, it's not strange to run into Latin and Latinx voters in Texas who are like, well, yeah, my people got here, but blah, blah, blah about these people trying to sneak over the border.
Right.
Even if you're just one generation.
There seems to be a higher self-identification with whiteness among certain Latino groups than I think people in the larger population really appreciate.
Right. I mean, what were we just talking about? Bill Maher and his other shenanigans. But what were we just talking about less than a week and a half ago with Lin-Manuel Miranda? Folks try and pretend that like Latinos are what they're not.
They're not.
Whether you call them Latinos or Latinx, and again, I've heard people make the argument, so I don't know which term is always the best to use. I'm not an expert in that particular area, but I mean, like, there are divisions within that community that matter. And so I say this to say the Democrats have never been particularly effective at messaging. And what they often fail to understand is what really motivates people as opposed to what should motivate people.
And that really, for me, is sort of the core thing at this point. When you're looking at the challenges that we face on a number of fronts, we just talked about one today, and that's the court rulings that are coming down on some of these really, really important issues.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also look economically, you look politically, you look socially, societally, you look at how culturally the country is starting to change. And even within that change, to your point about what you see evolving within the Hispanic community, the Latin community, is this sort of divergence amongst, and it's probably much more historical with them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, folks from Spain are not the same as the folks from Mexico, not the same as the folks from Puerto Rico, right, or, you know, Central America, not just in terms of culture, but in terms of skin.
Yeah.
And all of that. Whereas for Black folks, Black was Black. It ain't get all mixed up till white folks showed up, right?
Nope.
And then so it's interesting how within the Hispanic community, you have that sort of Heisman move by certain groups within the community saying, mm-hmm. oh, no, I'm this, they're right. something else. Whereas light-skinned Black folks and dark-skinned Black folks, there was never that sort of, oh, no. I mean, people may try to pass as white back in the day, but in large measure, the community kind of shut it down. I mean, it just kind of like, no, we're just not going to do that. Or am I off on that assessment?
I think you're off. Okay. I think you're off. But I think you're off only from this perspective. There were internal divisions. I mean, it was school days, good and bad hair.
Well, that's my point. That's right. Good, bad hair. Right.
Yeah. But at the same time, the larger hostility of white supremacy in America said, I don't care because you're all still blank, right?
That was like, my point.
That's
effectively, I mean, sort of shut down. That distinction, while it was there, and school days and other shows kind of point that up. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, there still may be some elements of it. But it's, you don't have a lot of light-skinned Black people running around town talking about, well, I'm not with them,
no.
You know, and you know, they living over there in the hood, and that's not me. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least not publicly.
Well,
I guess
here's
what I'm saying:
access to whiteness, philosophical and ideological whiteness, is not necessarily driven by phenotype anymore. Right. If you want to be allied with conservative white supremacist forces in this country, and again, just because you're white doesn't automatically mean you're a conservative or any of those things. I'm making that distinction clear. But if we were just going to play the skin color game, goodness gracious, rest in peace Herman Cain or Tim Scott. I mean, right. like clearly, right. there's nothing wrong with being a darker skinned African. There's some interesting philosophical things that go with this that I wrote about once that I'm going to be very careful about how I discuss this.
Right.
But what I will say.
I know. Go ahead.
Yeah. But what I will say is that, you know, skin color, the shade of Blackness that you are, is not necessarily your pathway into higher echelons of white support and power in this country today.
Right.
You know, conservative Black people come in all colors. Liberal Black people come in all colors. And I would argue that, again, if you look at everything from Tim Scott to Daniel Cameron if we were to speak anecdotally, you know, the last several super prominent African-American Republicans, you know, who were, you know, close to the brown bag test, you would have to go back to like Ward Connerly. Everybody else look like me. I mean,
right. And for folks who are trying to figure out what the hell any of this has to do with voting, it does, because it makes the point that for Black and brown people, all of those elements that we were talking of, Jason and I were just talking about, as tortured as we were talking about it, trying to step on eggshells here, carefully, still drives home the point that you have right now systemic efforts that whether you are a light-skinned Black person mm-hmm. or a white Hispanic person, you still gonna get screwed at the ballot box.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what the core of these efforts have to focus on, is the authors of these bills, mm-hmm. these laws, don't give a damn that, you know, some Hispanic people may say, well, I got here this way, but those right. folks at the border. Nah, baby, you in the state of Texas. Right. Your last name is Hernandez or yeah. Miguel, fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And you fall into the same little bucket as that brother living down around the corner from you, who's from right. Mexico, mm-hmm. or that other brother living down around the corner from you, who's from Watts.
Right.
So right. it's exactly. all the same. And I think that that's really the critical piece, how us ethnics, and I love the way you, I love the way you started this part of the conversation off, because you said, you know, the Irish, the Italians, and the Germans decided to become white.
Yep.
Because they could.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not the story for the rest of us.
Nope.
No matter how fair-skinned you are.
And never will be.
And never will be.
And I think as these kinds of arguments are being made, and these kinds of arguments are being made again by the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party. And here's the thing. It's not that I think the Republican Party is smarter. I don't even know that I think the Republican Party is better at messaging. I think the Republican Party is better at cohesive long-term strategy. Because if it goes by messaging, look, they've failed for years. They keep losing elections over and over again because the majority of the country doesn't like what they're selling. They have been winning because they have because through Mitch McConnell and other smart strategies.
They changed the rule of engagement with the system. They changed the system. Right.
Yeah. They just keep changing the rules.
They are the quintessential Captain Kirk in the Kobayashi Maru.
Exactly. I'm going to switch
just the system. Change the conditions of the test.
There you go. And you know, and the Republican and the Democrats hang around like Spock saying, but I invented this test. Right. I can't believe you broke it. Well, dude. You know, like, what do you think I was going to do? Lose? So, yeah.
I love that. Spock is like, yes, but I wrote that. That's not how I wrote it. Well, so?
Right.
So? Thanks. That's how I'm going to do it.
That's how I'm going to do it. You know? Right. And that's, again, therein is the inherent failure. You got to recognize that, you know, look, I mean, most people, like I said, most people don't necessarily want what this modern version of the GOP is offering,
right?
You know, but also we're in this place of, and I really think this has to be understood also when it comes to these voting right rules, is that prior to really 2012, right? And it's funny, I was just, Michael, I was just looking at this article. I was texting with a group of people a couple of days ago, and I found that old article by those former Clinton and whatever people, that were saying that, you know, Obama should drop out and let Hillary run in 2012.
Yes,
you remember that kerfuffle for like 4 or 5 days?
Very well.
And it was just so ridiculous.
I wrote a couple of those op-eds on behalf of Democrats. Yeah. Right.
I mean, it was such an insane idea. But the reason I mention is because maybe 8-10 years ago, you could play this game of elections were about getting out your base. That is no longer what elections are about.
Yes. No, they're not.
People are, and it's not polarization. I think polarization is also, it's an older term. It's a naive and non-nuanced term. I really do think, like people like Rachel Bykoffer and other people talking about, it's negative partisanship. People are now at a point, nobody doesn't know how they feel about this stuff anymore.
Right.
There are no such thing as swing voters and persuadable voters. And I've been fighting against that for years. It is simply about motivating people. Because they already know how they feel. And so Democrats have to, Republicans have recognized, we tap out really at about 43 to 44%. That's really where we tap out.
Well, and Trump proved that. He showed it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So since you can't win because we're not in a parliament, we literally just have to change the rules. We can't just tilt the board. We got to literally have the foosball table tilt to the side in our favor. And that's the only way
And the beauty of that, the advantage for us is that the other side thinks the table is still level.
Yes. Or they think if they just show enough effort, they can keep kicking the ball up the hill. And it's like, no, it's actually not how this works anymore. So all of that to go back to the Second Amendment. I will also say this, Michael, and this is encouraging to me in a way. Again, on the ground, Democrat organizers and activists have anticipated this. This has already been on their mind since last year. I don't think the administration gets it, because I don't think Joe Biden and I don't think Joe Manchin and I don't think Vice President Harris realize how serious this is. They may figure it out eventually, and they have until the end of the year. Like I said, I think some of this, I think part of the For the People Act is going to get passed. I don't think the whole thing, pieces of it are going to get passed before the end of the year. But they're not ringing the alarm bells on this. Every other word out of every Democrat's mouth should be voting rights and insurrection. I don't give a crap about infrastructure. It's ridiculous.
Well, that does it for this conversation this week, folks. You know, I love it when you do the download thing. Check us out on Stitcher, TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast on. Don't forget to share the love. And follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And you can follow Dr. Jason Johnson at Dr. Jason Johnson.
Yes.
It's real. It's
Dr. Jason Johnson on Twitter.
Yes. Dr. Jason Johnson on Twitter. And you really should, because not only do you get good insights on and analysis on what he's doing in politics, but his cultural stuff is the shit. It is. As he already said, he's getting tweeted at by NBA players because he's out there saying something crack ass about their team. And they're like, what the hell? It's all gold, folks. Trust me, this brother brings it culturally, politically, socially. He is Dr. Johnson. Thank you so much. Until next time, be safe, be well. If you haven't had the shot, get it, because I want you to enjoy the summer. And I don't need you spreading shit come the fall. So that's how that works. All right? We're going to keep it real. Until next time, I'm out.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.